Grant complained that Thomas's sluggishness prevented him from going for the kill. A permanent chasm developed between the two men. In peacetime, Thomas sought to reconcile with his family in Virginia, to no avail. He declined several offers to enter the political arena. Because of a short temper and devotion to honesty, he announced, "I have no taste for politics." Thomas commanded the Military Department of Tennessee for 2 years and worked hard to protect freedmen from white abuses. He similarly created a military commission to enforce labor contracts that local courts were ignoring. In a political move, President Johnson submitted Thomas's name for promotion to lieutenant general to replace Grant in 1868. Thomas refused the offer. "My services since the war," he replied, "do not merit such a compliment, and it is now too late for it to be regarded as a compliment if conferred for services during the war." Thomas sought and received command of the Department of the Pacific. He not only made no attempt to record his wartime memoirs, but also destroyed his private papers because he did not want his life hawked in print for the eyes of the curious. By 1870, he had clogged arteries from overeating and under-exercising, and his weight had ballooned to 245 pounds. That's when Thomas read a New York Tribune article in which General John Schofield was credited with winning the Battle of Nashville. At last, Thomas took pen in hand to make a strong rebuttal. On March 28th, halfway through writing his letter, Thomas said calmly, "I want air." He then slumped to the floor, dead from a stroke. Among the huge assemblage at his funeral in Troy, New York, were Generals Grant, Sherman, Sheridan, and Meade. Although no member of the Thomas family was in attendance, a sister told her neighbor, "Our brother George died to us in 1861. His legacy has never died, however. His staunch bravery and well-trained troops prevented disaster at several of the most momentous battles of the war. Some rank him as third greatest Union general behind only Grant and Sherman. He never would have accorded himself that honor, however. Thomas was content in the post-war era to keep on carrying out his duties in the same self-effacing manner with which he had served his country so well. Chapter 7. From the Front Lines to the Capitol. Winston Churchill once observed, "Politics are almost as exciting as war, quite as dangerous. In wartime, one can only be killed once, but in politics, many times." While Ulysses Grant proved this adage most consistently during his 2 terms as president, a host of other Union veterans fit the bill after the war. That may be because the qualities required by a commander do not work as well in the more nuanced art of persuading voters. That divide was not on the minds of the citizens in the North when their soldiers returned home. Each state had heroes with well-known exploits, and their instant name recognition worked as well back then as it does today. How well they served in public office proved to be another matter altogether. A prime example of a soldier-turned-politician is George McClellan, who created the North's premier army and then was fired for not employing it more in battle. He did not even wait until after the war to switch his coats. Disgruntled by his dismissal, he became the Democratic candidate who ran unsuccessfully against Lincoln in the 1864 presidential election. He went on to serve an unimpressive stint as the governor of New Jersey. Affable Ambrose Burnside followed a lackluster Civil War career by serving 3 terms as governor of Rhode Island. He eventually gained election to the U.S. Senate, but died after a few months at the post. The likable old Burn might have risen higher had he possessed more faith in his own abilities. In contrast, Daniel Sickles was a Tammany Hall politician in every negative sense of the phrase. He contributed a leg to the Civil War, which should have made him a hero, but spent his last years as a suspected embezzler. The path did not always lead from the battlefield to the podium. Abraham Lincoln appointed a number of high-ranking political figures as generals in the army. The rationale was that The war would be short, and the political generals thereafter would feel indebted for receiving generals' stars. Lincoln's selections in almost every case proved to be liabilities. Benjamin Butler had a terrible war record, but he was a powerful Lincoln ally, so he was continually sent to battle. He went on to serve a post-war term in Congress, where his futility held steady. He ran for Massachusetts governor 11 times before winning election. Judson Kilpatrick's Union cavalrymen called him Kill Calvary, for good reason. His insatiable sexual appetite made him unelectable to public office. Yet presidential appointments as ambassador to Chile kept him in politics, albeit at a healthy distance from Washington. Another political appointee, Oliver Howard, could not have been more different. The highly religious general wasn't so successful in war, but his stewardship of the Freedmen's Bureau after the war was admirable. Among all the corruption of carpetbaggers in the South, Howard earnestly tried to secure the rights to land and education for freed slaves. One of the most quoted of Union generals was Lawrence Chamberlain. The militarily untutored college professor gained fame several times in the war. Afterward, Chamberlain won landslide victories as governor of Maine. In his case, unhealed war wounds and academic feuds during his presidency of Bowdoin College prevented him from rising higher in the political constellation. Though all were tested on the same anvil of battle, these men showed colorfully different fortunes in higher office. Sometimes they brought the same virtues or vices to war as they did in peace. Sometimes what made them failures in war made them successful in peace. Either way, their fame would vault them in public office, where they were put on public display. George Brinton McClellan. More talk than action. No Civil War general inspired more passion and controversy than George Brinton McClellan. None augured more promise and delivered fewer results. Born to well-to-do parents in Philadelphia, the intellectually gifted McClellan attended the University of Pennsylvania for 2 years. He did so well in his studies that West Point waived the age requirement and admitted him as a cadet at the age of 15. The teenager graduated second in the famous class of 1846, which eventually contained 21 general officers. Engineering skills brought McClellan 2 brevets in the Mexican War. For a decade thereafter, he was one of the Army's most brilliant minds. He invented the McClellan saddle and the pup tent, in addition to translating 2 French manuals on bayonet techniques. The War Department chose him to observe the Crimean War and to record his observations and suggestions for American Army use. When military life contained no other challenges, McClellan resigned from service. By 1860, he was living in Cincinnati and working as president of what became the Illinois Central Railroad. When the Civil War began, McClellan accepted the governor's offer to take charge of all the Ohio volunteers. He was given a brigadier general's rank and command of the Department of the Ohio. McClellan won a couple of minor scraps in the mountains of western Virginia. The successes were ideally timed because they coincided with the defeat of General Irvin McDowell's army at Manassas. The North needed a hero, and McClellan stood in the wings. Lincoln summoned the young general to Washington and placed him in charge of the thousands of troops flocking to the capital. McClellan set to work using organizational skills matched only by his vanity. "By some strange operation of magic," he wrote his bride, "I seem to have become the power of the land." He looked the part. Only 34 years old, he was handsome as well as charming when he needed to be. His gray eyes were steady. His thick hair, mustache, and goatee imparted a look of wisdom. While average in height at 5'8", he had a 42-inch chest that hinted of sturdiness and self-assurance. McClellan was aware that his generalship could be a political path to the White House, So he carefully molded his 120,000-man Army of the Potomac. It received everything it needed, including organization, morale, and affection for and by its commander. McClellan was contemptuous of any civilian interference. He once referred to Lincoln as the original guerrilla. He considered it his army, and he never stopped believing that it should remain his. While McClellan was energetic in organization, he proved timid in battle. He thought too long and hard about a campaign he was going to make at some point. As a perfectionist, he was never quite ready to commit the army to battle. In fact, Lincoln, in 1862, had to order McClellan to take the offensive. His three-month Peninsula campaign failed not from McClellan's delays, uncertainties, and half-hearted tactics, but because, in his mind, heartless villains in Washington would not send him reinforcements for his army. He overlooked the fact that it already heavily outnumbered its opponent. His second encounter with Robert E. Lee's forces came in September of that year at Antietam Creek, Maryland. McClellan's piecemeal, uncoordinated attacks resulted in the bloodiest single day in American history. It was his refusal to pursue the badly wounded Confederate Army, however, that was the last straw for the ever-patient Lincoln. In November, McClellan was removed from command. The administration did not know what to do with him, so McClellan was ordered to Trenton, New Jersey, to await further instructions. His army career was over, but crowds cheered his return home. His appearance on a New York City hotel balcony, according to one reporter, was the signal for an outburst of enthusiasm simply impossible to describe. McClellan was convinced that the nation couldn't be successfully reunited under Republican rule. To all who would listen, he blamed the failure of his 1862 Peninsula campaign on a government that shamefully ignored his pleas for more soldiers. He was making these observations while still in the Army, and his $6,000 salary as a general was his only income. The federal government chose to ignore his public remarks. Throughout 1863 and into 1864, McClellan was vigorously entreated to run for the presidency, if for no other reason than to seek vindication for his mistreatment. He resisted such inducements by making the altruistic declaration that no man should seek the high office, but no true man should refuse it. He followed his own advice. The 1864 presidential race was a referendum on the war and emancipation. The Democrats opposed both, but McClellan repudiated a plank in the party platform that peace negotiations would immediately follow Democratic victory at the polls. McClellan also dismissed the slavery issue by proclaiming, "The Civil War should be a war for Union and Constitution and no other object." The party was far from unified. Hence, voters were given a ticket with a war candidate for president and a peace candidate, George H. Pendleton, for vice president. Lincoln won the electoral vote by a 10-1 landslide. Ironically for McClellan, Lincoln's margin in the popular vote was provided by Union soldiers. With no business prospects before him, McClellan went on a tour of Europe and did not return until after the 1868 election. He remained out of politics for almost a decade. In the interim, McClellan served as chief engineer for New York City's Department of Docks, established a consulting firm, and journeyed again to England, this time to promote his company. In 1877, to the surprise of many, he was nominated and elected governor of New Jersey. His stabilization of the uncoordinated bureaucracy and his financial frugality brought public praise. McClellan campaigned arduously for Grover Cleveland in 1884 with the expectation of being named Secretary of War. Cleveland won, but McClellan did not get the post. Another setback followed. McClellan had been composing his war memoirs and was two-thirds done when a fire destroyed his manuscripts. Undeterred, he started anew. Early in 1885, McClellan suffered an attack of angina pectoris. The recurring chest pains sapped his strength. On the morning of October 29th, he murmured, "I feel easy now, thank you," and then died. Funeral services were held at Madison Avenue Presbyterian Church in New York City, followed by burial in Trenton's Riverview Cemetery. His book, McClellan's Own Story, appeared 2 years later. Unfortunately, criticism outweighed praise. It was better for his memory, one reviewer concluded, had he left his story untold. Little Mac, as his soldiers had affectionately called him, has long been an enigma. Grant remarked that McClellan is, to me, one of the mysteries of the war. A master of planning, a failure in execution, he was a military genius crippled by insecurity. A Pennsylvania veteran commented a few years after the struggle, "Grant did not know how to retreat. McClellan did not know how to fight." That could be said for both their military and political undertakings. Ambrose Everett Burnside, Overcoming Wartime Failures. Ambrose Everett Burnside was a likable fellow. He made friends easily, smiled often, and remembered names. His successes were many, his failures disastrous. Born in an Indiana log cabin in 1824, Burnside received a West Point education. For 2 years, he served on the Western frontier as a member of the 3rd U.S. Artillery, and his captain was Braxton Bragg. In 1853, Burnside left the Army and settled in Bristol, Rhode Island, where he designed a breech-loading weapon known as the Burnside Carbine. Secretary of War John B. Floyd contracted with Burnside for the production of a large number of the carbines. Yet no sooner had Burnside constructed the Bristol Rifles Works than another arms manufacturer bribed Floyd to break the Burnside contract. Burnside had to sell the patent to cover his debts. To compound his futility, he ran for Congress in 1858 and was soundly defeated. The dual setbacks sent him westward. He settled in Cincinnati and became treasurer of the Illinois Central Railroad. There, a strong bond developed with an old West Point friend and fellow railroad executive, George McClellan. Burnside still retained a brigadier general's commission in the Rhode Island State Militia. At the onset of war, he returned east and accepted the colonelcy of the 1st Rhode Island Infantry Regiment. He displayed more confusion than action at the 1861 Battle of First Manassas. Nevertheless, he received promotion to Brigadier General of Volunteers. The following winter, he received rave notices for an amphibious operation at Roanoke Island, North Carolina. In truth, the Confederates lost the coastal toehold because of inferior numbers and inept leadership. Serious questions about Burnside's ability arose after the Battle of Antietam, where his attacks were unimaginative and tardy. Despite that background, Lincoln named Burnside in November 1862 to command the North's major force, the Army of the Potomac. Burnside openly confessed his unfitness for the post, but obeyed the order out of a sense of duty. In appearance, old Burn was a striking figure. He compensated for his premature baldness with a fantastic set of whiskers that made a double parabola from in front of his ears, down over his jaws, and up across his mouth. The whiskers were so unique that the fashion was thereafter called sideburns, Burnside's name in reverse. He customarily wore a high, bell-crowned hat with the brim turned down, plus a double-breasted, knee-length coat that made him resemble the caricature of a beefy policeman in the 1880s. While one general described Burnside as having a hearty and jovial manner with a good-humored cordiality toward everybody, those qualities did not bestow success as a leader of men. Another colleague said of him, "Few officers have risen so high upon so slight a foundation." This was only partly true. One reason for the affection given Burnside was his lack of ambition. He recognized his limitations even if he was never able to surmount them. Put another way, he did his best, but his best was usually not good enough. A month after taking command of the Army of the Potomac, Burnside led it to the most lopsided defeat it ever suffered at the Battle of Fredericksburg. 7 times Burnside attacked Lee's line. Concentrated Confederate fire easily repulsed each attack. Union losses were nearly 13,000 men. Lee had fewer than 5,000 casualties. A newspaper man wrote, "It can hardly be in human nature for men to show more valor or generals to manifest less judgment." Critics quickly dubbed Burnside the Butcher of Fredericksburg. He and his Ninth Corps were transferred to the Department of Ohio. Late in 1863, Burnside gained a measure of redemption by outmaneuvering General James Longstreet's forces and defending Knoxville, Tennessee against Confederate probes. Tying down Longstreet at Knoxville contributed substantially to Bragg's defeats in the November battles at Chattanooga. Burnside settled back into his usual bumbling in 1864. His supporting assaults at the Wilderness and Spotsylvania were disappointing, and his downfall came with his mismanagement of the 1864 Battle of the Crater at Petersburg, Virginia. Grant pronounced him unfitted for command and relieved him of all duties. The general settled in New York City to be near his railroad affairs, but he refused to take dismissal quietly. After a court of inquiry found him responsible through negligence for the July 30 massacre, he spent months in a futile effort to present his case personally to Lincoln or to Grant. Neither would agree to a meeting. In February 1865, the Joint Committee on the Conduct of War shifted the blame from the Crater disaster from Burnside to Army Commander George Meade. Though exonerated, he found the military wanted nothing more to do with him. A month later, a humbled Burnside sent a letter to Secretary of War Stanton. "If I can be of any service as a bearer of dispatches from you to either Grant or Sherman, I am quite ready." Stanton never acknowledged receipt of Burnside's willingness to be a messenger boy. On April 15, 1865, 4 years to the date of his joining the 1st Rhode Island, Burnside resigned from the Army. His ineptitude fortunately remained on the battlefield. By contrast, the amiable general's popularity with civilians was surprisingly high. In 1866, having switched to the Republican Party, he won election as Rhode Island governor by 3-fold majority. 2 re-elections followed. Because governing so small a state was a part-time job, Burnside was able to serve as director of numerous industrial and railroad corporations. That Union veterans liked him is evident from his election as 3rd Commander-in-Chief of the 450,000-strong Grand Army of the Republic Veterans Organization. In 1871, he was elected the first president of the National Rifle Association. By then, his waistband far exceeded the width of his shoulders. When bad investments caused Burnside financial difficulty, the state Senate appointed him to the U.S. Senate for 2 terms. He sat alongside former President Andrew Johnson and former Vice President Hannibal Hamlin. Burnside chaired the Foreign Relations Committee in his 2nd tenure. Brown University added luster to his career with an honorary degree. Burnside retired from public life and became a gentleman farmer, raising stocks of horses and cattle. He died December 14, 1881, of enlargement of the heart, according to the death certificate. His burial took place in Swan Point Cemetery in Providence. Today, on the statehouse lawn, is the usual equestrian statue with Burnside on top. He wrote his own epitaph with this wartime comment, "I have simply to do my duty. I can safely leave any claim I have to the judgment of future years and the justice of my fellow countrymen." That reliance on justice was his greatest flaw, Burnside's biographer concluded. Old Burn spent a lifetime with blind trust in the essential goodness and honesty of men. Daniel Edgar Sickles, A Rascal in Every Arena. Whether in politics or war, granite monuments or easy women, Daniel Edgar Sickles was never accused of hesitation. His early years as a Tammany Hall lawyer presaged the bombastic course of his entire career. As one writer stated, if history had not produced Sickles, a novelist would have had to invent him. Sickles attended New York University, gained admittance to the state bar, and quickly earned a reputation as an attorney who towed and occasionally overstepped the legal limits. As a member of the notorious Tammany Hall political machine, he was a corporate counsel at the age of 28. Sickles served briefly as a state senator before his 1857 election to Congress. His only positive contribution over the next 4 years was introducing a bill to make George Washington's birth date a national holiday. That was lost in the smoke of an 1859 scandal that attracted wide attention. Possessed of a brisk gray beard, dashing air, and good manners, Sickles had a well-known and widely practiced appetite for sex. To everyone's surprise, the 32-year-old congressman married the 16-year-old daughter of an opera director. The young bride failed to curb Sickles's lust, and he consorted openly with fashionable prostitutes. Yet, when the neglected Mrs. Sickles had an affair with Philip Barton Key, the nephew of the author of The Star-Spangled Banner, Sickles shot Key to death in Lafayette Square, across the street from the White House. His defense attorney, Edwin M. Stanton, had Sickles acquitted on the novel plea of not guilty by reason of temporary insanity. The well-publicized affair spelled the end for Sickles in politics, but he viewed the episode as a momentary setback. An influential New Yorker once observed, "One might as well try to spoil a rotten egg as to damage Dan's character." The Civil War opened a new field of opportunity. Authorized by the New York governor to raise a 1,000-man regiment and be its colonel, Sickles organized a 5,000-man brigade and demanded a brigadier general's commission, despite the fact that he was lacking in military experience. Limited action without making mistakes led to a promotion to major general and corps command under General Joseph Hooker, with whom Sickles shared a number of personality traits. Sickles then demonstrated that his military incompetence matched his personal vanity. At the 1863 Battle of Chancellorsville, he left open a gap in the lines that contributed directly to the Union defeat. 2 months later at Gettysburg, Sickles, without orders, shifted his corps from the safety of Little Round Top to a defenseless peach orchard in front of the Union lines. In the July 2nd fighting, Sickles lost a third of his men as well as a leg. He was directing his troops when he was struck by a cannonball that left his right leg dangling below the knee by a few shreds of flesh. As Sickles was borne to the rear, he lit a big Havana cigar and puffed it ostentatiously to the cheers of his men. Good old Dan proudly donated the severed limb to the Army Medical Museum in Washington and visited the shattered bones periodically for the rest of his life. A rumor spread through the Army that had not Sickles lost his leg, he would have been court-martialed. Certainly no Army commander desired his services thereafter. Rather than retire gracefully from the scene, the fiery Sickles used his political connections in an effort to regain his corps. Failing in that, Sickles and his cohorts launched an attack on Army Commander George Meade. Sickles brazenly asserted that Meade was preparing to retreat from Gettysburg, but Sickles's courageous action in the peach orchard forced Meade to stay and fight to a victory. When reports spread that Sickles was being considered for head of the army, pious General Oliver Howard wailed, "If God gives us Sickles to lead us, I shall cry with vexation and plead to be delivered." In fact, Sickles spent the remainder of the war jockeying in vain for a field command. The post-war years were equally tumultuous. President Andrew Johnson placed him in command of the Military Department of the Carolinas, but then had to fire the general for acting like a dictator. Sickles promptly joined the radical Republicans seeking Johnson's impeachment. In 1869, newly elected President Grant wanted no part of Sickles. He appointed the one-legged general as ambassador to Spain, with the sole task of acquiring Cuba. Instead, Sickles engaged in an open and wild affair with exiled Queen Isabella, the hereditary ruler of Spain. Apparently, her sexual vitality equaled that of Sickles. The hobbling general, he preferred crutches to an artificial limb, returned to America in 1874, still fully energized. He won a term in Congress and, ironically, considering his part in the battle, spent much of the next quarter century working to get the Gettysburg battlefield turned over to the federal government as a national park. Then chairman of the New York State Monuments Commission, Sickles toiled arduously for state and unit monuments to blanket the hallowed grounds. He was a man who rarely took no for an answer. Once, when he was asked at Gettysburg where his own monument stood, Sickles snapped back, "Hell, they're all my monuments." In 1912, Sickles was forced off the New York Commission when an audit revealed $28,000 in arrears. No charges were brought against him, in deference to his age and position. His last years found him separated from family and reality. He had squandered an estimated $5 million in the post-war period. Sickles lived to be 94, irresponsible and cantankerous to the end. He died May 3, 1914, of a cerebral hemorrhage at his New York City home. His burial in Arlington National Cemetery was a far more formal ceremony than good old Dan merited. However, he would have felt fully deserving of the honor. Benjamin Franklin Butler, hated from army to office. A shifty, cross-eyed Massachusetts politician, they called him before he became the first volunteer major general in the Union Army. Thereafter, he was the most hated man in every corner of the Confederacy. Mean-spirited, egotistical, and self-serving, Benjamin Franklin Butler fairly earned his nickname, Beast. His father was a privateer who died in the West Indies from either yellow fever or hanging, sources vary. Butler managed to graduate from Colby College and established a large criminal law practice in Boston. He was initially a Democrat who, at the party's 1860 presidential convention, voted 57 times for the nomination of Mississippian Jefferson Davis. The disgruntled Butler then supported the state rights candidate before transferring his allegiance to the Republican Party. President Lincoln named Butler a major general solely because of the New Englander's political influence. He proved to be a man of many talents, but being a soldier wasn't one of them. In his youth, Butler had applied for admission to West Point and been rejected. During the war, he always resented the academy graduates with whom he had to associate, yet he would have profited by learning some lessons from them. Only weeks after war began, and totally without orders, Butler and a contingent of troops seized the pro-Southern city of Baltimore. General-in-Chief Winfield Scott angrily relieved Butler from the command. Yet the North applauded the action. Lincoln, politically calculating, gave Butler command of the military department along Virginia's seacoast. He immediately precipitated another crisis. Three slaves escaped into Union lines, and in spite of the 1850 Fugitive Slave Act, Butler refused to return the bondsmen to their owner. Instead, he declared them contraband of war, property of men in rebellion, and hence usable by the federal government. Butler's June 10, 1861 attack at Big Bethel was embarrassing for its ineptitude, and he was shifted off the battlefield to a position where he hopefully could do no more harm. In the spring of 1862, he became military governor of New Orleans. Butler's grotesque appearance matched the ruthlessness he unleashed. Tall, paunchy, and bald-headed, he had a set of arms and legs that, to a staff officer, looked as if made for somebody else and hastily glued to him by mistake. A left eye noticeably out of alignment, drooped as heavily as his mustache. A Billy Yank remembered Butler coming out of his tent, looking in all directions at once. Butler's dictatorial rule of New Orleans was as efficient as it was distasteful. One man who defiled the American flag was instantly hanged. Shop owners who refused to sell to federal soldiers had their businesses shuttered and then sold. Theft and corruption became the order of the day, and Butler was given the sobriquet Spoon for the family silver that was regularly confiscated. The most remembered of his directives came after local women repeatedly snubbed or insulted Union soldiers. General Order No. 28 announced that henceforth, any female who, by word, gesture, or movement, displayed disrespect to a Union soldier could be treated as a woman of the town plying her avocation. Butler, in short, officially condoned sexual assault. A negative outcry came from Europe as well as from Southerners. President Davis branded Butler an outlaw and enemy of mankind, which meant that he could be executed without benefit of trial. As it turned out, the order was more smoke than fire. No federal soldiers were insulted, and no New Orleans women were assaulted. Butler was returned to the battlefield because he was so popular with both radical Republicans and war Democrats. In 1864, he somehow gained command of the newly created Army of the James. His assignment was to march westward up the James River and approach Richmond from the underside. What resulted was one of the most mishandled campaigns of the entire war. Butler let inferior numbers drive him into a broad peninsula jutting out into the James. Confederates quickly dug in across the neck of the peninsula, leaving the Union Army locked up as securely as cattle in a corral. The hapless general still retained his political influence with Lincoln, however. Though he was a key ally of Lincoln for the upcoming election, he not only allowed radical Republicans to consider him as an opponent to Lincoln in the presidential race, but also agreed to be Lincoln's running mate if chosen. Lincoln did toy with the idea of designating Butler as his running mate, but fortunately, it was a passing thought. In December, Butler's bumbling attempt to seize Fort Fisher on the North Carolina coast finally brought an end to his military career. A Union Corps commander dismissed him as helpless as a child on the field of battle and as visionary as an opium eater. His military failures did not mar his political standing. After the war, Butler served 9 years in Congress. He chaired the House Committee on Reconstruction, which framed the military occupation of the southern states. Ever in the limelight, he was one of the prosecutors in Andrew Johnson's impeachment trial. Butler flew into a rage when Senator Edmund Ross cast the deciding vote against impeachment and shouted, "Tell the damn scoundrel that if he wants money, there's a bundle of it here to be had." He ran for governor of Massachusetts 11 times before winning the office. By then, he was grossly fat and immensely wealthy, but he still enjoyed a good political fight. He was so nearsighted that he had difficulty signing the oath as governor. Butler campaigned in vain to get the Republican presidential nomination in 1884. A few years later, the retired general and politician had a surgical procedure to remove a section of his left eyelid because the eye had almost closed. Surgeons cut a wedge from the lid and attached the remainder to his eyebrow so that it would be wide open tight to allow maximum light. Butler endured the entire operation without anesthesia and then entertained the physicians at dinner. 2 years later, Butler published his memoirs. The 1,100-page narrative explained away, at least to Butler's satisfaction, every charge of failure and corruption in a half-century of public life. On January 10th, 1893, a day after arguing a case before the U.S. Supreme Court, Butler suddenly developed heavy breathing and coughing. He died before the day's end of what was diagnosed as pulmonary congestion and heart failure. Butler was buried in his wife's family cemetery in Lowell, Massachusetts. Constantly motivating Butler were the demands of soaring ambition. He was unpredictable because he was an opportunist to every shift in the wind. always suspected of misdeeds but never convicted of any lawbreaking, he was all that one dislikes in a politician. Hugh Judson Kilpatrick, Killer of Cavalry. A ranking staff officer declared that it was difficult to look at Union General Hugh Judson Kilpatrick without laughing. Wiry and undersized, with stringy side whiskers, he had a lantern jaw and seemingly no upper lip. Kilpatrick wore carefully tailored uniforms, thigh-high boots, and a felt hat tilted to one side to achieve an urbane effect. He seemed woefully out of place in an army of grown men, and in this case, appearances did not lie. In no other Civil War officer was valor more overcome by vices. Born on a New Jersey farm in 1836, Kilpatrick determined early to make himself a good soldier en route to a governorship and the presidency. He performed well at West Point, despite a proclivity to settle cadet arguments with his fists. Playing leading roles in school dramas made him such a good speaker that he gave the valedictory address at his 1861 graduation. Kilpatrick married on the same day he left for war. Trained officers were badly needed for the thousands of recruits answering their country's call. He was a captain in the 5th New York when wounded in a June 10, 1861 skirmish at Big Bethel, Virginia. Supposedly, Kilpatrick was the first regular Army officer injured in action. He submitted his official and somewhat exaggerated report of the action not only to the War Department, but to the New York Times as well. The published account brought him national attention. Promotion to lieutenant colonel and colonel of the 2nd New York Cavalry followed. During 1862, Kilpatrick conducted a number of independent raids in northern Virginia. He spent much of his time engaged in contraband, confiscating horses from farmers and setting aside the best ones to sell for himself in the North. Similarly, he stole tobacco stockpiles and sold them to Army sutlers. After he was caught stealing a team of mules, Kilpatrick's other thefts came to light. He was arrested and put in Washington's old Capitol prison. Secretary of War Edwin Stanton stated, "The affidavits leave no question of his guilt." Those crimes should have ended Kilpatrick's military career, yet the Army was desperately in need of experienced cavalry leaders. Kilpatrick won restoration to duty after a 3-month jail stay and subsequently rode with General George Stoneman in a raid on Richmond. The campaign threw the Confederate capital into momentary panic but gained no military fruits. At Brandy Station, the largest cavalry battle of the war, Kilpatrick performed capably, though as usual, incurring high losses. Shock ran through the Union ranks a week later when Colonels George Custer, Elon Farnsworth, and Kilpatrick were promoted to brigadier generals. Kilpatrick was 27, and, in the words of General George Meade's chief of staff, "an arrant knave and imposter, not capable of commanding even a battalion." Kilpatrick confirmed that judgment a week later at Aldie, when he recklessly made piecemeal attacks that brought stunning casualties. Thereafter, he was known as Kill Cavalry. The same overly aggressive leadership came to the forefront on the third day's fighting at Gettysburg. Kilpatrick sent a brigade in a mounted charge through woods and across rocky terrain. The assault was bloodily repulsed. Kilpatrick blamed defeat in his official report on a lack of infantry support. His negative reputation was now fully established. He boasted that he was afraid of nothing in battle and that heavy losses were the cost of victory. Yet his results were never equal to his bragging. Further, while Kilpatrick did not gamble or drink, his pursuit of women was notorious. Females of loose virtue frequented his headquarters. In the spring of 1864, desperate to regain his status as a hero, Kilpatrick received permission to make another raid on Richmond. The expedition failed so badly that Army Commander George Meade demoted him. Kilpatrick requested transfer to the Western Theater, and surprisingly, General William Sherman welcomed him. I know that Kilpatrick is a hell of a damn fool, Sherman stated, but I want just that sort of men to command my cavalry. Kilpatrick served well with Sherman in the advance on Atlanta, the march to the sea, and the push through the Carolinas. Yet his recklessness was replaced by ruthlessness. His men committed every kind of devastation, a Southern diarist wrote. Soldiers even robbed slaves of their clothing. In one instance, Kilpatrick needed horses to replace worn-out mounts, and his men collected 500 more animals than necessary. To solve the problem, Kilpatrick ordered the horses slaughtered in the front yard of a plantation. Meanwhile, the general had at least two mistresses accompanying him, and one bore him a child. He and the other were frolicking at his headquarters when a band of Confederates made a surprise attack. Kilpatrick escaped, clad only in his underwear. A major general at war's end, he resigned from the army in August 1865 to campaign for the Republican candidate in the New Jersey gubernatorial election. I'm not willing to see the rebels of the South, whose hands are yet red with the blood of our fallen brave, restored to their old rights and privileges, he said. But when Kilpatrick's man failed to gain the Republican nomination, he went to work for his opponent. The general's rhetorical skills led to the man's election. President Andrew Johnson rewarded Kilpatrick's party loyalty by appointing him ambassador to Chile. On board the ship, bound for Santiago, Kilpatrick met another passenger, a Mrs. Williams, the young, attractive wife of a naval officer stationed in Panama. The two immediately began an affair that continued a month into his Santiago residency. At state dinners, Kilpatrick introduced Mrs. Williams as his wife. When this news reached Washington, Kilpatrick came close to losing his post. He forced his consort to leave the embassy, and she ended up as a street prostitute who freely recounted her previous experiences when soliciting. Kilpatrick, in turn, married Luisa Valdivieso, cousin of a future Chilean president and niece of the Catholic Archbishop of Chile. The new Mrs. Kilpatrick was 5 feet tall, with hair so long that it tumbled all the way to the floor when not braided around her head. Kilpatrick's one notable proposal, as ambassador, was an effort to persuade England, France, Russia, and Italy to form an armada and destroy the Spanish fleet. The four nations reacted with disgust. After returning to America in 1868, Kilpatrick saw the futility of running for public office. His opponent had only to make reference to Mrs. Williams, and Kilpatrick's candidacy was dead. President James Garfield reappointed Kilpatrick ambassador to Chile, probably because of his wife's connections. It was a short-lived assignment. In the scant months he had left, Kilpatrick gave most of his attention to a verbal war with the American legate in Peru, General Stephen Hurlbut. The feud ended November 4, 1881, when Kilpatrick died of nephritis in Santiago. His remains were buried at West Point. At least one of his bad deeds was rectified. 2 years later, having learned of the Mrs. Williams affair, Kilpatrick's mother-in-law had her daughter's body and headstone removed from next to Judson Kilpatrick's grave and sent to New York City for reinterment. Oliver Otis Howard, Pious Crusader. Oliver Otis Howard was an enigma. He left much to be desired as a military commander, but proved to be a devoted, albeit frustrated, humanitarian in the years of peace that followed. No officer entrusted with the field command of soldiers, a historian recently concluded, has ever equaled Howard's record for surviving so many tactical errors of judgment and disregard of orders emerging later with increased rank. Yet his pious efforts, both for former slaves and for education in general, did much to offset his checkered record as a career soldier. Born in Maine, he graduated from Bowdoin College and spent an additional 4 years at West Point. In 1857, while on duty in Florida, Howard converted to evangelical Christianity and gave serious thought to entering the ministry. The coming of the Civil War erased that idea. Howard accepted the colonelcy of the 3rd Maine and led one of the Union brigades that was driven in confusion from the Manassas battlefield. In spite of the disorderly retreat, Howard received promotion to brigadier general. In his next battle, Seven Pines, Virginia, in May 1862, a wound necessitated the amputation of his right arm. Howard accepted the loss fatalistically. His only known witticism came from a meeting with General Philip Kearny, who had lost his left arm in the Mexican War. Howard commented, "There is one thing we can do, General. We can buy a pair of gloves together." The amputation brought elevation to Major General and later a Medal of Honor. Reorganization of the Army of the Potomac early in 1863 put Howard in command of the newly formed 11th Corps. The 12,000-man unit contained a large number of German-American regiments that had seen no action of note. Jingoism was strong at the time, and the 11th Corps was widely ridiculed as Dutchmen of second-class status. Howard's penchant for strict military and moral discipline collided with the soldiers' continental-style free-thinking and heavy drinking. Corps and Corps commander had difficulty accepting one another. A staff officer noted, "Howard would be a decidedly handsome man, were he a little taller, having a high, projecting forehead with a comely beard and very thick head of hair. He has been placed in an unfortunate position, being given the 11th Corps, a body of very inferior material." At Chancellorsville, these outcasts were placed on the far right of the Union line. Late on the afternoon of May 2, 1863, Stonewall Jackson's Confederate Corps slammed into Howard's flank, like the eruption of a volcano, as one Billy Yank exclaimed. Federals broke from the field in the first stage of what became a decisive Union defeat. 2 months later, on the first day's fighting at Gettysburg, Howard's corps collapsed again under fire. Some 4,500 Federals were captured in addition to those killed and wounded. Howard fell back through town to a position atop Cemetery Ridge, where he engaged in an untimely argument with Union General Winfield Hancock over seniority of command. The Christian soldier was not above enlisting God in defense of his actions. He ended his official report of Gettysburg with this statement: "No candid mind can review those scenes of horror and doubt and ultimate joy without feeling constrained to acknowledge the divine hand which controlled and directed the storm." For his role in the battle, Howard received the thanks of Congress. Many soldiers did not feel the same. Following Gettysburg, they openly referred to the general as "Uh-oh, Howard." He and his troops were transferred to Sherman's command in the West. The pious, straight-laced Howard seemed out of place in an army of loosely disciplined Midwestern farm boys. Yet under Sherman, Howard performed well for the remainder of the war. The years after Appomattox were more fulfilling. On March 3, 1865, Congress enacted the Army Bureau of Refugees, Freedmen, and Abandoned Land Act. It was the Northern government's first welfare agency. A War Department-controlled experiment to help both blacks and whites readjust to a post-racial society. The Freedmen's Bureau, as it came to be called, was designed to feed the poor, establish schools and hospitals, find jobs for the unemployed, negotiate labor contracts, and allocate land to freedmen in a wide-ranging redistribution process. In May, President Andrew Johnson appointed Howard as the Bureau's commissioner, a post he held until the agency's 1872 disbandment. Howard's many efforts were conscientious and impeccably honest. Because he considered education as the best route for freed slaves, he kept the Bureau focused on building schools. Yet the agency's overall success was limited. From start to end of his tenure, Howard waged an uphill battle. A moderate anti-slavery man before the war, he assumed his new duties with the best interests of ex-slaves at heart. The problem was he had the power to exercise only the government's wishes. Johnson gave him no support, congressional appropriations were inadequate, and white Southerners opposed all reforming efforts. Inside the Bureau, many of the employees engaged in an orgy of fraud and corruption. In the end, and despite his efforts, Howard failed to gain landowner status for freedmen. In addition, the legal and physical protection that the Freedmen's Bureau provided ex-slaves became short-lived. In his longest-lasting effort, Howard, in 1872, began serving as president of a college he had created as an institution to train future black ministers. Although he served only a short tenure as president of Howard University, and he encountered continual opposition to educating former slaves, the college went on to become one of the preeminent black institutions of higher learning in the United States. It trained generations of black professionals during the long years of de facto segregation and lent strong support to the civil rights movement. 2 years later, the one-armed general went west to counsel with warring Indian tribes. He was able to broker an uneasy peace with the Apache and Nez Perce. When West Point's first black cadet committed suicide, Howard was named superintendent to restore calm at the academy. His greater achievement, many said, was improving the quality of food the cadets received. Thereafter came command of various military districts for Howard. While commanding at San Francisco, he became prominent in religious circles. Much of his time was devoted to preaching, finding positions for clergy, and organizing revival meetings, and reminding people that he was not an ordained minister. Service in New York City strengthened his friendship with General Sherman, and Howard was put in charge of the commander's 1891 funeral. He was also instrumental in the establishment of Lincoln Memorial University, a school for indigenous mountain residents in Kentucky, Tennessee, and Virginia. Now respected and applauded, Howard lived to try every day to make somebody happier and better. His memoirs, published in 1907, are highly embellished and rarely quoted. On October 26, 1909, Howard died of a heart attack. He was buried in Lakeview Cemetery, Burlington, Vermont. The Guard of Honor was a contingent from the 10th Cavalry, an all-black regiment. Near the end of his life, Howard observed, "My glory, if I ever have any, consists in results attained, and the results in the case of the Freedmen's Bureau are, for me, more marked than those of the war." Such also is the judgment of history. Piety is not needed for a military command, but it served Howard well at a crucial juncture in our history when his crusade for racial fairness was roundly opposed. Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain, from teacher to hero. Education also featured prominently in the career of another general from Maine. Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain underscored the old adage that sometimes the pen is mightier than the sword. He was relatively unknown until the 1975 appearance of Michael Shara's novel, The Killer Angels. The 20th Maine, Chamberlain's regiment, was blessed with a good regimental historian, and that book, plus Shara's imagination, turned a college professor into a folk hero. Two movies and a PBS documentary catapulted Chamberlain into almost idolatrous fame. The tide is now receding with the knowledge that Chamberlain overly publicized his accomplishments, which were not as singular as they appeared, and he memorialized at times rather than reported accurately. Born in 1828 in Brewer, Maine, Chamberlain was a descendant of a long line of soldiers. He also received his first education at a military school. These two facts debunk his claimed lack of martial knowledge when he entered the Civil War. In 1852, Chamberlain graduated from Bowdoin College. 3 years later, he received a degree from Bangor Theological Seminary. He returned to Bowdoin as a professor of logic and theology, position that had previously been held by Calvin Stowe, whose wife wrote the powerful novel Uncle Tom's Cabin. Chamberlain's professorship carried academic tenure and a 2-year sabbatical leave to study in Europe. The tall, heavily mustached academic hardly seemed destined to be a heroic soldier. He was soft-spoken and philosophical, perfectly at home in his academic cocoon. Patriotism disrupted Chamberlain's serenity. In 1862, he applied for his sabbatical leave and left Bowdoin, not for a European tour, but to become lieutenant colonel of the newly formed 20th Maine. He worked earnestly to learn the rudiments of command. The regiment reached the Army of the Potomac too late to participate in the Battle of Antietam. Its baptism in battle came in December with the murderous slaughter of the army at Fredericksburg. The Maine unit was engaged in one of the final useless assaults. Chamberlain and his men spent the night pinned down on the field by Confederate fire, using dead Union bodies for cover. A smallpox quarantine prevented the 20th Maine from taking part in the 1863 Chancellorsville action. Instead, its most publicized fight came July 2nd at Gettysburg. Desperately anchoring the Union left flank against attack and out of ammunition, Chamberlain ordered his troops to counterattack with only bayonets and cheers. Confederates, suffering from heavy losses and a lack of water, fell back in retreat. Chamberlain's leadership earned him a Medal of Honor. For a year, the colonel alternated between regimental and brigade command. Court-martial duties held him back from the first battles of Grant's 1864 Overland Campaign against Richmond. Yet on June 18th, at Rives Salient near Petersburg, Chamberlain led a charge. When the color bearer fell dead, Chamberlain seized the flag and held it aloft for his men. A bullet slammed into his right hip, sliced at least one artery, nicked his bladder, fractured his left pelvic bone, and exited behind his left hip joint. Bleeding heavily, Chamberlain thrust his sword into the ground for support and continued shouting orders until he collapsed. Surgeons on the scene pronounced the wound fatal. Chamberlain's brother rushed him to a field hospital, where two physicians pulled together as much of the complex damage as possible. As he clung to life, the colonel sent a farewell letter to his wife. The army issued an obituary, and General Grant promoted Chamberlain on the spot to brigadier general, one of only two such battlefield promotions in the Civil War. His health slowly improved, although the widespread injury plagued him for the remainder of his life. In February 1865, he rejoined the army, limping badly, but with his usual determination. On March 29th, in a sharp fight at Lewis's farm on the outskirts of Petersburg, he was wounded again. A bullet passed through his horse's neck, struck Chamberlain just below the heart, and passed out his coat. The wound from the spent bullet was more painful than severe. Grant recognized Chamberlain's valor by recommending him for promotion to Major General and accorded him the honor of receiving, on April 12th, the official surrender of Lee's army. The general returned home a crippled hero. Without discounting his bravery, part of the reason Chamberlain was so lauded is because he insisted throughout the war years that any exploit he accomplished be widely publicized in the press. His war experiences expanded the professor's ambitions. After serving for a year as acting president of Bowdoin College, he ran for governor and won 70% of the votes. He was reelected 3 times, twice by the largest margins in Maine history. Although Chamberlain sought higher office than the 1-year governorship, the opportunity never came. Debate over his support of temperance and opposition to capital punishment cost him popularity. He left politics in 1870 when he became the unanimous choice for president of Bowdoin. He was head of the school for 12 years, and in those more rudimentary days of higher education, he taught every subject in the curriculum except mathematics and physical science. So long a presidential tenure inevitably spurred dissatisfaction among professors and alumni. In Chamberlain's case, he was too far ahead of his time. He overmodernized the curriculum, often in the face of strong opposition. What proved the largest bone of contention was his institutionalizing of a military program and drill system for all students. Future wars were inevitable, the general firmly believed. Younger generations should be more prepared for military duties than was the nation at the outbreak of the Civil War. A student uprising on campus brought the issue to a head. In the end, Bowdoin adopted the policy, but abolished it a decade later. The military curriculum battle, plus a flare-up of his war wound, produced ongoing stress with his wife that led to the rim of divorce. Chamberlain resigned the college presidency in 1883 and underwent major surgery on the still unhealed hip wound. He almost died as a result, and his pain and disability continued. Chamberlain spent his remaining years in various business ventures, nationwide lectures, and active participation in veterans organizations. His gift of articulation made him one of the most quoted veterans of his age. He was a star attraction at the 50th anniversary of Gettysburg when thousands of veterans gathered for a reunion. By then, with the war injuries inflamed and his rejection of any further treatment, Chamberlain described his days as unspeakable agony. He managed to complete his memoirs of his last year of Army service. The Passing of the Armies, published posthumously, was more a lawyer's brief defending the removal from command of his friend General G.K. Warren and laced here and there with snide comments about Grant and Sheridan. The wound eventually overcame Chamberlain altogether. By January 1914, he was bedridden. He wrote to his sister, "I am passing through deep waters. The doctor thinks I'm going to land once more on this shore." On January 24th, Chamberlain died of chronic cystitis and chronic posterior urethritis. Although he wanted a simple service, a huge number of mourners attended the funeral in Brunswick's Pine Grove Cemetery. Maine citizens still regard him as their most famous soldier. Chapter 8: An Unsteady White House. The long-held belief that good generals instinctively make good presidents has been discounted by history. George Washington was the first military commander to lead the nation, and numerous others followed in his wake during our first full century. 7 American presidents are associated with the Civil War, and Abraham Lincoln towers over all. While he would be a giant in any age, the latter half of the 19th century was littered with one-term presidents whose legacies are mostly negative. Indeed, they seem to be mere bystanders as the gathering forces of industrialization propelled America to the world's foremost economic power. 3 rank among the least admired presidents. The worst of the bunch was also the first, James Buchanan. He maintained a lawyerly dispassion while the country disintegrated around him. After Lincoln came such slim pickings that Congress remained more in the spotlight than the White House. Andrew Johnson, a square peg trying to fit into a round hole, holds the lowly distinction of coming within a single vote of impeachment. As for Ulysses Grant, he was apolitical before being elected, and he never learned enough about the presidency to wield its power. He is mainly noted for using nepotism to a degree unparalleled until the Kennedy era. The next 3 presidents on this list hailed from Ohio, long an important state politically, and one that rapidly industrialized during this period. Grant's successor, Rutherford Hayes, deserves praise for officially ending Reconstruction, but his impact is limited because he chose to serve only one term. That was longer than James Garfield, who was killed within months of his inauguration. The favorite among the sad lot was the last, William McKinley, who still is regarded as one of the best-liked presidents. Yet his laissez-faire policies toward big business led directly to the age of progressivism, when the forces of monopoly and labor abuse were severely curtailed. This era is also remarkable for the number of presidential assassinations. In a span of 40 years, three of these presidents were gunned down in their prime. While all the killers were deranged, their sundry motives sprang from the turmoil of the times. In particular, Charles Guiteau took the corrupt patronage system of political favors to its hideous extreme. When the post he sought was not forthcoming, he regarded killing James Garfield as the next best avenue. As for McKinley's assassin, Leon Czolgosz was an anarchist who justified killing the president because of his strong alliance with the business forces that he perceived were oppressing the masses. Although all these men knew the violence of war, they were not prepared for the turmoil of post-war peace. The tides of Reconstruction, industrialization, and mass immigration caused social upheaval on a scale that perhaps no president could have controlled. What we do know is that the training that these men gained in battle in no way prepared them for controlling the tumultuous era that followed. James Buchanan, the worst president. While Lincoln is considered the greatest of our chief executives, his predecessor is usually ranked as the worst. James Buchanan is remembered not for what he accomplished, but for what he failed to accomplish at the most critical point in the young nation's history. Buchanan grew up in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, only 10 miles from slaveholding Maryland. No other important pre-Civil War Northerner lived closer to the South. This proximity early on earned him the label of a doughface, a Northerner with Southern leanings. His first 65 years were largely uneventful, as he became a wealthy attorney in Washington. A fiancée died in 1819, and Buchanan kept his vow never to marry. One acquaintance commented that from the time Buchanan was old enough to vote, he had been wedded to the Constitution. He shared bachelor quarters in the Capitol with a number of men, many of whom were influential Southerners. Service in the two houses of Congress preceded his 1852 appointment as ambassador to Great Britain. That placed Buchanan a continent away from the increasingly heated debates over slavery. Because he was Kansas-less in 1856, he was considered enemy-less. Democrats chose him to run for president. Buchanan's sympathetic attitude toward the extension of slavery won him 14 of the 15 Southern states, and longtime Northern Democrats carried him to victory over the fledgling Republican Party. At 69, he began his term as one of our oldest chief executives. Buchanan was tall, with silky white hair. A neck injury at birth caused his head to tilt to one side, even though critics allege that Buchanan had tried to hang himself after a broken engagement. A badly squinted eye was also distracting. The former ambassador wore an old-fashioned standing collar and a starched white shirt, looking as if he had just stepped from a Charles Dickens novel. A pleasant fellow, he initially took daily walks along Pennsylvania Avenue, affably greeting one and all. A niece, Harriet Lane, served as hostess at the White House. Her poise and congeniality were such that the song "Listen to the Mockingbird" was dedicated to her. What Buchanan lacked was any ability to control the winds swirling about him. In the late 1850s, one crisis after another swept across the nation. The Dred Scott decision, the Panic of 1857, John Brown.